For AZPM, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, find out how a three-minute story can change lives. Learn about the process behind the annual Fast Pitch event that supports local nonprofits. Meet Mel Blumenthal, a storyteller with some interesting tales to share. And a newly restored print of a Mexican film from 1951 called Victimas del Pecado screens at the Fox Tucson Theater next week. I'll talk with the restoration specialist who has a personal connection to the film. And Krista Scheel offers his opinion on why it should be considered an overlooked classic. Those stories are next on Arizona Spotlight. The quest to find funding, resources, and connections for nonprofit organizations never ends. Next week, eight different groups that each work to improve and strengthen Southern Arizona will appear at Social Venture Partners' annual Fast Pitch main event, which is held live at the Fox Tucson Theater. In front of a global audience of changemakers and investors, the spokesperson for each group will have 3 minutes to make a pitch and share their passion for the causes they represent. The results could be life-changing for these groups and the people they serve. To help each organization through the process, Social Venture Partners also sponsors a 5-month program to help them create the perfect pitch. Effective storytelling is an important life skill, and joining me now to discuss the difference that it can make is Aaron Henney, an accomplished and multidisciplined theatrical artist who teaches the art of storytelling, and Brittany Battle, the Fast Pitch Director for Social Venture Partners. AZPM is a corporate partner and will be involved with the live event.
This program and this event is really an opportunity for people to get a deep understanding of what our community needs. And we utilize storytelling as a way for people to be connected to something that they might not be aware of, might not care about yet, might not know how they fit in. And storytelling allows for them to be invited into a new perspective.
What about the sort of competitional aspect of this?
We focus on camaraderie over competition. Our class, our nonprofit cohort, they come together unified on behalf of this community. We see that when nonprofits are working together in partnership, we can serve more people. We can understand that we're not alone fighting on the front lines of real critical issues. And so there are competitive elements, but it's with the support of one another that makes this such an exciting program and event.
Aaron, let's talk about storytelling. Good storytelling can benefit a person in many ways.
Yes, we are wired, I think, as humans, to respond to and to tell stories. You know, a lot of the ways we understand the world are through narrative, either through the narratives that exist or the narratives we create. You know, a way that people can relate to you is to hear your story, or there isn't a your story, there is one of many the stories that you carry and are a vessel for. And I think effective storytelling trusts that the listener doesn't have to know everything. And I think that's often where storytelling struggles, is people get nervous that if I don't tell you every detail, you won't get it. And I like to joke that then you get the glaze, you know, the glaze after a few minutes where you're deep in the details and you watch the eyes kind of glaze over. And so I think instead, trusting that it's good if your listener at the end has questions or wants to know more. For those who have the fear of public speaking and telling stories in public, what I would say is to remember that the listeners are not your adversaries. They are your friends. They are there because they want to engage. So one of the tips I give, don't look at the mass of people. Look at individuals. It's almost counterintuitive because it seems almost like it would be scarier if I meet the eyes of the people in the audience. But actually, I find for most people, not for all, you know, these are guidelines, not rules, that looking over the heads and just seeing the mass is where the fear raises. If I look in somebody's eyes just for a moment, I'm reminded that I am them and they are me, and I'm able to speak to them instead of speaking to the great them, the huge masses. And that's a way to start, at least, to remember that you're with individuals, you are not with a group.
What are you hearing from individuals in Tucson who may be leading businesses or communities who are concerned about representing a group, a whole?
I think one thing we really focus on in the pitch training is a lot of the people who lead or work with organizations do a lot of things, right? And they're feeling the burden or the responsibility of carrying the weight of all that, which you're alluding to, the weight of we do so many things and serve so many people and we're multifaceted. And what I say is, if you have 3 minutes, you're not going to tell it all. Focus today on knowing that you can kind of home in on an aspect and that that can be a placeholder for all that you do, that people will understand that if you're really saying, we serve the community in these variety of ways, but today I'm going to tell you about this part of it, they'll trust that there's more there. And I think some of it is you have to trust your audience, your listener, that they can take the leaps and that they don't have to know everything. But it's a real fear that they're going to underrepresent. I won't even say misrepresent, underrepresent, because they do amazing things and a lot of work. And one can only tell so much in a brief period.
The old adage is lead with a joke. You know, get them laughing and then you've got them.
Yeah.
That's not true, is it?
What I will say is it's not untrue, right? There are times that that's the case. I'm a believer that effective storytelling is based on who you are and how you communicate. So if you're somebody who that's your natural state, is to kind of lead in a way that's humorous, then go for it because that's true to you. But for a lot of people, that's not where they live. And we can feel it. We can feel the kind of push to make people laugh. What I usually recommend is lead with the why. Lead with the reason that your services or what you provide to the community is needed. Talk about what is either missing or is working in the community that you're building upon. Start with that need and build from there. And people are then with you because they know why they're listening. They understand what the need is that you're helping to serve or be a part of or fulfill upon.
Storytelling has the power to stir up any emotion. And if you're intentional about what it is you are trying to connect with someone else, then you can make them laugh. You can make them activated in a way they might not have been before. And I think just being aware of that and understanding that every moment, every minute is precious, whether you are in the hallway with someone, grocery store, otherwise, impactful things can happen in a space that you allow it when you are ready to share something with someone and when someone's willing to receive it.
Thanks to my guests, Brittany Battle and Aaron Henney. The 2024 Fast Pitch main event will be Tuesday, March 26th at the Fox Tucson Theater. There is something very powerful about a single voice sharing a true story. It gives a chance for the storyteller to let their personality shine while forging new connections with anyone who listens. In support of this important community tradition, Arizona Spotlight will now feature a different storyteller on the third Thursday of every month. Here's Tony Paniagua to introduce us to a member of Female Storytellers in Tucson, which has been supporting and promoting events for more than a decade.
Mel Blumenthal, the Outreach Director at FIST, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mel, the organization FIST was founded in 2012. There are other storytelling groups. Why one specifically dedicated, if you will, to women?
FIST was founded in 2012 by a woman named Lauren Wiggins. And Lauren and I were actually working together at the same agency back then, and she was just starting to dip her toe into the stand-up comedy scene. And what she was finding was back then in 2012 that there weren't a lot of women voices in that scene, and especially there weren't a lot of spaces where women and female comics had the opportunity to be heard and seen in safe, inclusive spaces. So one weekend, Lauren goes out on a holiday to Los Angeles, and she comes back and she walks into my office and she says, Mel, I just saw the most incredible thing while I was out in LA. I saw this group of women who just were telling stories about their life, performing up on a stage, and they were beautiful, and some were just hilarious, and some were just tragic, and it was all just the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And I want to start that here in Tucson. And to be totally honest, I never thought she would do anything with it. I did not think that she would actually get this off the ground. And that was probably in summer of 2012 and or spring. And by September 2012, FIST had their first show.
At one point, it used to be FST, F as in Frank, S as in Sam, T as in Tom, yeah. Exclamation point. But now it is F*ST. Can you tell us about that change along the way?
We wanted to add the asterisk to be more intentional and inclusive of femme, non-binary, trans women, and marginalized genders, to really broaden who we were attempting to serve and want to bring onto our stage.
And you've been at it ever since, once a month with storytelling, and there are themes that are provided in advance. Can you tell us how the process works, for example, if somebody hears this interview and wants to participate?
Absolutely. So we circulate that theme or that writing prompt. We have them published on our website, so you can find it there, or folks can sign up for our listserv. And then we invite folks from the community who are female identified to just write in stories about their real life experiences, however that theme or prompt speaks to them. And that's how you can get involved in being a storyteller. And then how you can get involved other ways is just come to the show.
You also have another aspect to your organization. You're helping out the community.
Yeah, we have a philanthropic nature about us. So every month we host the live storytelling shows, and then 70% of our ticket sales we then donate to a different local community charity organization. So we really like to give back to the community while the community in turn supports building community through the awesome power of storytelling.
Mel Blumenthal, the Outreach Director for FIST Female Storytellers right here in Tucson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And now we're going to hear a story from you.
I'm sitting on a train in Munich, reading my book, trying to look as inconspicuous as possible, praying that the controllers who have just boarded to check passengers for tickets pass me by, because I don't have one. Not because I don't know to, but because for the past 2 months I've been living here, I've been gambling with their honor system of buying tickets. In Germany, there's nothing stopping you from getting on the underground metros other than a kiosk. But they have a Big Brother is watching system of patrol, in that random controllers will appear on trains at any given time to conduct ticket checks. And I'm well aware of this. But I'm not going to tell them that. See, Munich is expensive. It was September of 2009, and in the wake of the financial collapse, I had lost my job, my house, and my graduate funding in about a 3-week time period. In April of that year, I had been hospitalized for weeks and told that I was going to die. I had run away from home to see doctors in Germany for the serious neurological condition that I could not get attended to or even afford to get treated for in the States. But I wasn't thinking about any of that right then. All I was thinking about were those two controllers, because they were standing right above me, and I needed a plan. Okay. I already don't speak German, so I'm going to pretend that I don't speak English either and resort to my second language, Italian. Yes, genius. But like any good American with a loose concept of European geography, I was consistently forgetting that Italy is only about 5 hours away from the German border, so solid plan. Far Carter, ticket, they yell at me. Because everything to me in German just sounds like yelling. I look up, confused. Ticket, they now say in English. I still look up, bewildered. Follow the plan. Out of nowhere, this very lovely woman sitting next to me grabs my arm and says, oh, François, Espanol, Italiano, Portuguese, and two other languages I can't even make out. I'm thinking, lady, you are killing me. The one time Italian can be useful to me outside of a restaurant, and I happen to sit next to the world's most helpful UN interpreter? The controllers are now glaring at me. Panic sets in. Mezza chiudo niente? Yes, panic-induced genius. A hybrid of Hebrew, Spanish, and an Italian I'm sorry? Yeah. Surely the controllers will think I'm some foreign tourist from some unknown strange country and just leave me alone. Because who wants to waste their time and deal with that? Ha! Take that, confused-looking UN interpreter. Nobody can make out that language. But she could, and so could the controllers. It was the universal language of BS. And I had seriously underestimated my host nation, because this was Germany. And these are Germans. And I had broken a rule. And regardless of the severity of the infraction, I was to discover that afternoon, rule breaking of any kind is not something Germans abide. After I was pulled off of the train and placed on another, where I was taken back to the central station, made to interact with 5 to 8 other transit and law enforcement agencies, I wish I was making that number up, endured an hour more of scolding, and escorted to pay a fine, I was free to go. That German doctor did wind up saving my life, and I was able to come home and have a new beginning. And now, whenever I travel back to Germany, I always buy a metro ticket. Well, almost always.
Our storyteller was Mel Blumenthal, the outreach director for FIST. Their live storytelling events happen each month at The Rock on Park Avenue, south of the U of A. For information, we have a link on the Spotlight page at azpm.org. A 1951 film from Mexico has just been lovingly restored, and it is surprising modern audiences with its unusual blend of genres, a story crafted around difficult themes, and some thrilling Afro-Cuban music and dance. You'll hear more about the film soon from Chris DeShiel, but first, I have a conversation with filmmaker Viviana Garcia Besne, an expert technician when it comes to film restoration. She also has a deep personal connection to the film called Victimas del Pecado, or Victims of Sin.
This is a very personal restoration for me. This is a film that was produced by my family in the early 50s. The main actress, Ninon Sevilla, was one of the most important actors that the company had hired. I met Ninon Sevilla towards the end of her life. And I don't know why, because she used to have a very private personal life, but she chose me to tell me some of her stories. telling me things that were very hard to hear about my family. So for many years, I kept those stories in the back of my head. And when I started my work restoring films, I immediately thought, I do need to restore Ninon Sevilla's films, and I need to tell the world her stories and restore her role as a producer of these films too.
How much of an impact did her career have on the Mexican film industry? Was she well known in her life?
Oh, huge, huge. Ninon Sevilla is not Mexican. She was born in La Habana, Cuba, and she came to Mexico as a very young girl. And very quickly, she became a movie star. My great uncle, who was at the time a very famous film producer, saw her dancing at a nightclub the first week that Ninon was dancing in Mexico. And he fell in love with her and went backstage and asked her to go out with him and promised to make her a movie star. And Ninon said, no. You first made me a movie star and then I will go out with you. And that was the beginning of an amazing love affair between an actress and a producer. And we all know, you know, stories like this, they produce amazing films. So Ninon Sevilla films were extremely successful, not only in Mexico, but also, I will say, in Europe.
I'd like to refer back to the beginning of the interview when you said that you got to personally know her and hear stories about her career and your family, and that some of it was difficult to hear. Do you feel comfortable sharing with us what one of those aspects might have been?
Yes, in the case of victims of sin, it is very tough to share, but I think I have to. Ninon Sevilla, she was never able to marry my great uncle because Mexico was very classist and also very Catholic country. It was not well seen that a producer will marry the actress. So they had a very long affair. Ninon, she was never able to become a part of the family. And 3 weeks before the shooting of Victims of Sin, Ninon Sevilla was forced to have an abortion. So when you see the film and you know this, the film becomes a different film because there's a whole story with a baby in the film. And a lot of people have praised Ninon Sevilla's acting during the film. And she told me, of course I was acting, but of course I was using all the pain that I had inside of me because of the abortion. I feel when I see her films that there's so many parts of her life that she was never able to discuss with the press or with anybody else. But somehow you can see them on the films if you know her story. And this makes each one of her film a treasure because we can put together her life through her films.
What about the practical story of restoring victims of sin?
This was a very, I will say, straightforward, but at the same time, difficult restoration. We had access to the best available element, which is an original camera negative nitrate. And that was fantastic to begin with. When we restore a film, and I do this work with Peter Kornheim, who is an amazing, amazing genius of restoration work. Of course, I want to encourage the people to watch the film and just enjoy it. But at the same time, I want them to pay tribute to this woman. So I think it is important for the audience to know that when these films were screened in Mexico, people were not, just sitting and watching quietly the film. People were actually interacting with the film. This is one of the reasons why there are so many dancing numbers during the whole film, because people will stand up and dance, or people will clap after each number will finish. I will really encourage people, if they like the musical number, to clap their hands, let Ninon Sevilla know that she did a good job. I think it is amazing when people come together in a movie theater to watch a film, and then they respond to something from the story deeply from their hearts. And you can feel that. And that brings tears to me.
That was filmmaker and film restorationist Viviana Garcia-Besne. Next, a review from film essayist Chris DeShiel, who begins by praising the director and cinematographer of Victimas del Pecado. They were acclaimed artists whose talents were sought out specifically by the producer and star, Ninon Sevilla.
In classic Mexican cinema, the two artists commonly considered the most important were the director Emilio Fernandez, nicknamed El Indio, and the cinematographer Gabriel Figueroa. Most acclaimed were their movies about peasants and rebels in rural Mexico, such as Maria Candelaria, which won the Golden Palm at Cannes in 1946. Both learned a lot from Hollywood methods, and both went from merely imitating U.S. films to giving their own pictures uniquely Mexican themes and styles. But although poetic dramas were their specialty, they also made forays into popular urban genres. A most unusual example, something unique to Mexican film, was the cabaretera, a combination of the musical, taking place mostly in nightclubs and cabarets, with the crime film and the melodrama. Their best film in this genre is their 1951 picture, Victimas del Pecado, or in English, Victims of Sin. A cabaret dancer has had a baby out of wedlock. She brings the infant to the father, a swaggering pimp and thief played by Rodolfo Acosta. He refuses to admit that the child is his, and the young woman is so pathetically dependent on being with him that she obeys him when he orders her to abandon the baby in a trash can on the street. With a story of such corruption and depravity, it can seem a bit of a shock for the film to also include musical numbers. But so it does. And this is how we meet the star of the movie, the spectacular Cuban-born dancer Ninon Sevilla. She plays Violeta, lead performer at the cabaret. With her blonde hair and unconventional beauty, Sevilla dominates the film with a series of amazing Afro-Caribbean dances. She choreographed all of her own numbers in merengue and conga dance styles, and magnified their power with a unique, sexy, hip-shaking and jumping technique. She's sensational. Fernandez stages these nightclub scenes brilliantly. You can always see the dancers at full length. The movie features the so-called Mambo King, Perez Prado and his band, and the great singer and pianist Rita Montanaro gets to perform as well. The songs are playful and more suggestive than most of what you could see in Hollywood musicals at the time. In the best of Sevilla's dances, she's paired with an excellent black conga performer, and that the dance is interracial is not meant to seem at all remarkable. Once again, something you never encounter in Hollywood. Meanwhile, as the story continues, Violeta learns about the abandoned baby and manages to save it from the trash can. The club owner won't allow her to keep it. She defies him and gets fired, and then resorts to prostitution in order to survive. Sex work is depicted much more openly than you would ever see in the U.S. back then. Not that there are any sex scenes. This is 1951, after all. It's just that the movie doesn't try to hide what it is we're talking about. Violeta resists the aggression attempted by the villainous pimp, who is the baby's father, and there's a remarkable sense of outrage challenging the authority of abusive men throughout the film. Women's pride and right to dignity are championed. Male power is attacked and defeated. But there are contradictions. The environment of seedy nightclubs that is also connected to prostitution is assumed to be just the way things are. A rival cabaret owner and pimp, played by Tito Junco, is presented as a more generous alternative. Yet when all is said and done, Sevilla, playing the heroine, is always at the film's dynamic center. But overall, Victims of Sin is a handsome, slick, enjoyable, and in some ways daring product. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel.
Cinema Tucson presents Victimas del Pecado, starring Ninon Sevilla and directed by Emilio Fernandez, at the Fox Tucson Theater next Wednesday, March 27th. Cinema Tucson curator and film distributor Carlos Gutierrez will speak after the film. Ticket information is available on the Spotlight page at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show is a production of AZPM. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance by Alicia Vasquez. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.